Oh, I didn't need that. Oh, those lights are always so bright. Well, good morning, everyone. I am April Lynn Cowett. I'm one of the members of our teaching team here. If this is your first time here, welcome. Welcome to the people online, wherever the camera is. And yeah, we're glad you're here. So today is the second week of our new sermon series called Strength to Love. As we approach elections in November, the teaching team wanted to turn our focus on Sunday mornings to how we can promote unity and be agents for change in the world around us, rather than participating in division and disunity. So to inspire our talks over the next 8 weeks, including this week, we are drawing on wisdom from Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., in this collection of his sermons called Strength to Love. We're specifically using the chapter titled Paul's Letter to American Christians as our inspiration, which is a red letter written by Martin Luther King using the style of the Apostle Paul. But before we get to any of that, I wanted to play a short video by way of introduction. So take it away, Jared.
Shimu, fast fashion from China. Buy online now. Style for less.
Way less.
Unbeatable prices. Dress, $10. Shoes, $5.
How so cheap?
Don't worry about it. Men's t-shirt, $3. Not made with forced labor.
Okay.
Modern styles, designer dupes, no prisoners involved.
Did there used to be or something? Why bring that up?
Tank top, $3.99. New merch daily. Fresh fits. No prisoners. Normal number of working hours each week.
So like 40 or...
Or.
Or what?
Don't worry about it. Matching sets, $2.50. All workers paid, even ones with wrong religion.
Wait, what?
Shimu, best factories, happiest workers.
Oh wait, there's like a note sewn in my jacket.
That's a thank you note from a happy worker. Best materials. Quality craftsmanship.
Oh.
Premium fabrics with no lead.
See, that makes me think there is lead in this.
No lead. Good clothes. Best prices. Minimal lead.
You said no lead.
Kind of smells like gasoline.
Okay, this is giving shady. Be real, is this shady?
If it was, would you stop buying it?
No.
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 Maybe. No.
Great. Shimu. Don't worry about it.
My shoe.
Great. So you might be wondering what in the world this has to do with Martin Luther King Jr. That is a great question. And I'm going to ignore it for now and move on. But I will get to it. So be patient. Last week, Wayne introduced us to Dr. King's letter by way, So Paul, by way of Dr. King, has greeted the American church, and he's praised us for all the wonderful advances that our country has made in the realms of science and technology. However, he goes on to question whether our moral and spiritual progress has kept pace with our scientific progress. He says, "It appears to me that your moral progress lags behind your scientific progress. Your mentality outdistances your morality, and your civilization outshines your culture. You have made of the world a neighborhood, but you have failed to employ your moral and spiritual genius to make of it a brotherhood." He goes on to remind us that our highest loyalty should be to God and His will, and that as Christians, we've been called to be a light on a hill that shines the light of godly justice regardless of what the rest of the world around us says is light. So, in today's section of this imaginary letter from Paul slash Martin Luther King turns his attention towards our economy. And here's a bit of what he says. "I understand that you have an economic system in America known as capitalism, through which you have accomplished wonders. You've become the richest nation in the world, and you have built the greatest system of production that history has ever known. But, Americans, There is the danger that you will misuse your capitalism. Now, if you're at all familiar with the real writings of the Apostle Paul, you know that he was not known for mincing his words, and neither was Dr. King. He says, "You must use your powerful economic resources to eliminate poverty from the earth. God never intended one people to live in superfluous and inordinate wealth, while others know only deadening poverty." Yikes, right? Well, it's been almost 60 years since Martin Luther King wrote this letter. How is America doing? All of us know that wealth inequality is still a huge issue. Have we made any progress in closing the gap? I have some charts and graphs that I was going to show you, but in the interest of time, I won't, even though they made me look like I really knew what I was talking about, which was great. I did include a slide at the end of my message that has some links for further reading, and I included a link for those charts if you wanted to take a look at them. But in short, no, wealth inequality is not improved since MLK wrote this letter. And in fact, the gap between the wealthy and the not wealthy has only gotten worse. In fact, that gap didn't just double or triple or quadruple in 60 years. It has grown to be 35 times larger than it was. And that's even after accounting for inflation. Not only that, but in the last 40 years, the inequality in wealth between white families and families that were classified black or Hispanic has grown substantially. In 1983, white families had an average wealth that was about four times greater than that of black or Hispanic families. In 2022, the average wealth of a white family was about six times greater than that of a black or Hispanic family. Now, I have a confession to make. Economics is not my strong suit. The irony that this was the topic I ended up being assigned to speak about today is not lost on me. So if you came here today hoping for some wise financial advice or brilliant solutions about how to solve our nation's economic problems, sorry, you're going to have to try a different church or wait for another speaker, at least. But since the core of today's topic is economics, I figured I should at least start with some basics, like even just a definition. That much I can give you. Now, in searching the internet, I found a few different ways of defining what economics is. I even took a look at the introduction for Economics to Dummies, which should be, up there. Spoiler alert, that's me. I'm the dummy. And out of the definitions that I looked at, one really struck me, and it, in fact, pretty much inspired the rest of this talk. So, according to the University of Buffalo Department of Economics, economics is the study of scarcity and its implications for the use of resources, production of goods and services, growth of production and welfare over time, and a great variety of other complex issues of vital concern to society. Now, as I read this, one word stood out to me, and you've probably figured out what that word is because I highlighted it conveniently for you. It's the word scarcity. Now, I may not know a lot about economics, but I do know what that word means. It's the opposite of abundance, right? In an ideal world, we have unlimited amount of resources, or an abundance of resources. But here on Earth, our resources are limited. And when the demand for those resources is higher than what's available, scarcity occurs. Now, where have we heard the word abundance recently? If you were part of our community for the first 6 months of this year, you might think that word sounds a little familiar. Yeah, that's right. It was part of our definition of shalom. Now, as a reminder, shalom is a Hebrew word that loosely translates as peace, but it goes so much deeper than just a world without conflict. When we talk about shalom in the context of the kingdom of God, this is what we mean. We mean a flourishing and abundant relationship, not lacking anything with God, with each other, with nature, and with ourselves. And it's shalom, this sense of deep peace and abundance and rightness, that's at the heart of our faith. So that sounds like pretty much the opposite of the world we live in, right? Especially these days. I don't want to speak for all of you, but I know for me, I feel like I never have enough. Never enough time, never enough energy, never enough money, never enough sleep. But honestly, I know I'm fortunate. I may not have even close to everything that I want, but I do have more than enough of what I need. It's likely that some of you know what it's like to truly struggle. You may not know if you're always going to have enough food for you and your family. You may not know what it's like to have a home. Or you may struggle with health conditions that make it difficult for you to work and struggle. You struggle to get by on the aid that you receive. I don't think it's any mystery that it's hard for us to feel true peace, when it feels like our resources are stretched too thin. But I want to take a deeper look at this and show you how scarcity isn't just an economic issue or a social issue. It's a spiritual issue that truly affects all of the areas that we mentioned in our definition of shalom. Scarcity has implications for our connection with God, with each other, with nature, and with ourselves. So to start, I want to go back to the book of Genesis. Now, just as a reminder, at the very beginning of the book of Genesis, we get the story of how God has created this beautiful garden. He's created the earth and everything in it, including humans, and he's put the humans in the middle of this garden. And this is what it says. The Lord God planted a garden in Eden, in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground, the Lord God made to spring up every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life was in the middle of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "You may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die." So here we have a picture of shalom, perfect abundance and flourishing. And most of us know what happens next. The serpent comes along and he makes the humans question whether God really has their best interests at heart. And instead of checking in with God, they decide to trust the serpent instead. And they eat from the tree that God told them not to. And they're suddenly filled with shame and fear, and they start blaming each other and the serpent and hiding from God. And God sends them out of the garden before they can do any more damage. What was meant to be a perfect relationship of trust and love and peace, in a place where humans had more than enough of everything they needed, turns into a disaster for humans and the earth. And here's what God says to Adam after the humans confess what they've done. And to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat of the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." So we can see the language of scarcity here. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. Now, during our Shalom series, we talked about this tension between the way of Shalom, God's plan for us, and the way of empire, the way we choose for ourselves. Whether or not you believe in the literal historical Adam and Eve. The idea is that instead of trusting God to say what's best and provide for us, we say, no, we want to choose what's best for us and make our own choices. And God has no choice but to send the humans away from paradise, because that seed of doubt and rebellion has been planted, and it's just going to continue to grow. But this isn't where I want to sit. I wanted to start in the garden as context for the next story about what happens with two of Adam and Eve's children, the brothers Cain and Abel. Now, Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it." So, here we have the story of two brothers who were among the first humans to live under the consequences of Adam and Eve's actions in the garden. Like their father, one of them is a keeper of animals and the other grows crops. And even here we see that humanity's relationship with God has changed. It's different. In the garden, there was no mention of the humans bringing offerings to God. This is the beginning of a kind of transactional relationship between humans and God. The humans grow crops and raise animals, and then they give some of that back to God, presumably as a sign of their gratitude or allegiance to him. Or at least one of the brothers was grateful. Again, we don't know exactly why God doesn't deem Cain's offering acceptable. The most common interpretation is that it's because Abel gave his offering from the firstborn of the flock, whereas Cain just gave a non-specific offering of his crops. But it's also possible that it had nothing to do with the type of offering they gave, and that it's just that Abel made his offering with a more appropriate attitude. Either way, Cain doesn't give his offering in the right way. And we can see by his response that God, his response to God, this isn't just a matter of Cain making a mistake out of ignorance. He doesn't reply by saying, "You know what, God? Yeah, I'm sorry, you're right, let me make it up to you." Or he doesn't even say, "I didn't know, give me a chance to make it right." Cain responds by being very angry. Why is he so angry? It's because he's living with a scarcity mindset. Now, what do I mean by a scarcity mindset? This is a concept in social psychology that explains there are two different ways of thinking about our wants and needs and the resources we have available. So people with an abundance mindset, they're the people that tend to see the glass as half full. They see the world as full of opportunities, and they ask, "What can I do with what I have? Or what do I need to learn?" On the whole, they're pretty optimistic about the future. When they look at the world, they see abundance, even when they're aware that there are limitations to the resources they have available. With a scarcity mindset, people tend to see the glass as half empty. When they look around themselves, what they see is troubles and problems, and they focus on the things they can't actually do anything about. They see things generally as falling apart. These are the people who see the reality that the resources available to them are limited, and they respond with fear and anxiety. And keep in mind that when we talk about resources, we're not just talking about physical goods. These could be ideas like time or energy or even affection. So, getting back to Cain, he knows those crops weren't just given to him. He worked hard to grow them. And whether it was through holding back the best crops for himself and giving God just some of the leftovers, or simply by giving his offering reluctantly, maybe with a bit of bitterness that he's expected to give part of his crop to what he had worked so hard for, back to the God that had put them in the situation in the first place, whatever the reason, God knows that Cain's heart isn't really in it. And that's because he doesn't really think God deserves the offering. In contrast with the abundance that his parents experienced in the garden, all Cain knows is a world where you need to work hard to get what you need, and he doesn't want to give any of that up. Now, most of you probably know what happens next, but let's keep reading. So Cain spoke to Abel, his brother. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" He said, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." So now, not only is God stumped God, Cain has stumped God, he's now guilty of murder. As they say, that escalated quickly. But this shows that Cain isn't just being a petulant brat who doesn't like being scolded. He's so angry about the way that God responded to him that his anger extends now to his brother. He doesn't see scarcity just when he looks at the hard work he put into his crops and how he's being forced to give a portion of that to God. In his eyes, there also isn't enough of God's approval to go around. He deserved God's acceptance, and he didn't get it. Never mind that it was his fault in the first place for not thinking highly enough of God to give the proper offering. He doesn't see it that way. From where Cain is standing, God is the one who's being unreasonable here. You see, when resources are scarce, that means there might not be enough to go around. And if there isn't enough to go around, some people are going to get what they need, and some people won't. And if that's the case, then we need to decide which people deserve to get those resources. That's how our thinking tends to go. And so we start setting up this worldview of us versus them. We can't treat everyone as our neighbor if it means we might not get what we want or what we need. It means that some people are our competition, our enemies, and we need to deal with them accordingly. So, sorry, I'm very allergic for today for some reason, probably because it rained last night. So excuse the sniffling. So Cain decides that Abel is his enemy, and he kills him right there in the fields where they work. Cain's envy over the way that God treated Abel just sends him further and further into the jaws of the sin that God had warned him about. Now, when God confronts Cain over what he did and doles out judgment on him, we might think that would be the moment that Cain finally realizes what's happening to him, realizes he has to make a change. But let's read this one last bit of his story. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain still refuses to take responsibility for what happened, and he complains that yet again, God is being unfair. The scarcity that Cain saw everywhere is just multiplying. Now he can't even work as a farmer at all. And from his perspective, God has gone from not approving of him to completely turning away from him and abandoning him to be killed by someone else. And this story sets up a pattern that we see repeated over and over, even in the world around us. Once we've created these categories of us versus them, the worthy and the unworthy, we grow to envy the people who have the things we want but don't have. And if we let it, bitterness will take root and keep growing. We see this message throughout the Bible. For instance, in Proverbs it says, "A heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones." Here, envy is described as a kind of cancer or decay that eats away at the very core of our bodies. Pretty much the exact opposite of a heart at peace, or as some translations say, a sound heart. And James says this, "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You desire, but do not have, so you kill. You covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. When you ask, You do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures. So I think most of us understand a little bit about what James is saying here. Why is there so much anger and fighting in our country and in the world? We fight over material resources. We fight because our sibling is getting more of the attention from our parents. We fight out of fear that if the wrong candidate wins the election, their policies won't get us what we want, or they'll turn the country in a direction that looks to us more like scarcity. Immigrants will take our jobs. People who didn't work for it will get our tax money. The other candidate will take away our rights or our health care or our access to medicine. Don't get me wrong, these are all valid concerns. But when we let our fear drive us, it can spiral out of control. And suddenly, we're acting a lot more like Cain than we'd probably admit. Being willing to kill an entire relationship because someone we love started siding with the wrong position. And we were more concerned with being right than with treating them as a neighbor, as a fellow human being created in God's image. Now, I want to repeat something I said earlier. Scarcity, or more specifically, a scarcity mindset, isn't just an economic issue, or a political issue, or a societal issue. It's a spiritual issue that affects every aspect of our ability to be agents of shalom in the world. So I want to look at a few examples of ways this shows up in our lives that might not be immediately obvious. And this is where I get back to Shimu. In case it wasn't clear, that was not a real ad. It was a parody ad from SNL, but it was parodying a couple of real companies called specifically Temu and Shein. I think that's how you pronounce that. Temu is the one I'm going to focus on, but just because that's the one I researched. So if you're not familiar with it, Temu is an online merchant that's one of the most popular apps right now in the United States. I believe it's in the top 10 apps at the moment. It's known for its tagline, shop like a billionaire, and its incredibly low prices for a very wide variety of goods. As an example of the sorts of deals you can score, I made this sample Temu order, and if I'd hit submit, I would have been able to buy a pair of sneakers, a dress, a cute pair of Halloween earrings, and a pair of comfy pants for under $31, including taxes and shipping, all without leaving my house. So, what's the catch? We know there has to be a catch, right? Is this a scam? Well, Temu and its prices are actually completely legit. But, as with anything, you get what you pay for. Since the orders are shipping directly to customers from Temu suppliers, most of which are overseas, sometimes your order might not arrive. And when it does, product quality can vary. This month, in fact, a TikTok user went viral for coming home on a hot day to find out that the croissant-shaped lamp she bought on Temu was swarming with ants. And after breaking the lamp in half and tasting it, she confirmed it was a real hollowed-out croissant that had been covered in resin with a lamp added to the inside. And to be fair, it turns out there was an artist in Japan who was doing this exact thing, treating pastry that would have gone bad otherwise with antifungal and anti-whatever chemicals and selling them for hundreds of dollars. But clearly, this lamp did not get the proper treatment to protect it from the ants. So, yeah. But still, Temu and businesses like it, even Amazon, they're great for those of us on a budget. We don't need to drive around town looking for that one random computer adapter we need. We don't need to go hit the outlets and fight the crowds to get a great deal on a dress that we need. We don't need to fight off the angsty teenagers in Spencer Gifts looking for that perfect gag gift. We can find whatever we need from the comfort of our bed, and at way less than we pay for it in person. But sadly, the bad product quality and dodgy delivery is not the end of the story. A digital vetting company recently discovered that at least some of the products sold on Temu were known to be manufactured in the northwestern Xinjiang province of China, a region which the U.S. has banned all imports from due to its known forced labor practices, mainly against the Muslim ethnic minority groups that live there. Since 2022, over 3 million people have been relocated and brought to re-education centers and internment camps in this region through the government-funded Poverty Alleviation Through Labor Transfer Program, where they're subjected to political indoctrination, family separation, constant surveillance and isolation, forced work for little pay, forced sterilization and abortion, and involuntary implantation of birth control for population control. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying that the things you buy from Temu or Shein or Amazon or AliExpress definitely come from forced labor in detention camps. We don't have a direct link that those products they found were from a forced labor camp. What I'm saying is there's a confirmed link between that region, known for these practices, and some of these products came from that region. But we do know that Temu doesn't have a system in place for vetting where its products come from, other than by getting its suppliers to sign saying they won't use forced labor. And since many of these products are shipped directly from the suppliers to customers, they can bypass customs investigations because the threshold for those investigations is $800. And a lot of those goods are things that we never knew we needed, like croissant lamps, and things that we never actually needed in the first place. We're buying them because we're getting a great deal, so why not? And speaking of buying things, another way that our scarcity mindset affects more than just our own peace of mind is through overconsumption. When we view resources as scarce, we don't just take what we need. We take more than we need, sometimes way more. We buy too much of everything so that we have a surplus when supply runs out. If you've ever lived any place with blizzards, you've seen this in action every time the weather forecast calls for snow, and suddenly the grocery store shelves are empty of water, canned goods, ice melt, and kitty litter. Or during the first year of the COVID pandemic, when suddenly toilet paper was the hot commodity. Now, this is all well and good when we're stocking up in cases of emergencies. But we Americans don't just do this when a storm is coming, do we? We overbuy food all the time. I can't tell you how often I personally have had to throw out produce I forgot about or ignored until it spoiled. And I know I'm not the only one. And it turns out that we're terrible at judging just how much we waste. According to a 2018 study, on average, Americans think that we waste about 15% of our food. In reality, we throw out nearly a quarter of all the food we buy. And you might say, sure, but at least it's biodegradable. And yeah, that's what I would say too. And it turns out that's a problem, because as it decomposes in landfills, it creates methane gas to the tune of 50 million gas-powered cars worth of greenhouse emissions. To put that in context, 50 million is just shy of 20% of the total number of motor vehicles that are registered in our country. So imagine taking all the cars we drive and adding another 20% of that on top of it. And that's how much our food waste each year is contributing to greenhouse gases. And you might think, well, that's probably like the companies, right? Like they are distributing. No, 50% of this food waste almost is caused not by problems in the supply chain, but by individual consumers. So I have one more example, and then I'm going to move on to some more hopeful words. So I've said that when we see the world through the lens of scarcity, we can't see everyone as our neighbor. We have to see some people as less deserving. We end up creating categories, us versus them, the deserving versus the undeserving, our allies and our enemies. And to make sure that we and our allies get the resources we deserve, we design our world in a way that keeps the thems at bay. Border walls come to mind as an obvious example, but perhaps a more subtle form of this happens through hostile architecture. This is a term for the intentional use of urban planning and design to change people's behavior. So, Hostile architecture can be used for sanitary reasons, such as these sloped urine deflectors that were built in European cities in the 19th century, designed to make it more difficult and or unpleasant to urinate in street corners. Or it could be used to discourage sleeping in public places, such as these benches with metal bars installed every few feet. Or it could take the form of bolts and spikes on stairs and window ledges to keep people from sitting where you don't want them to sit. Now, I'm not saying that hostile architecture is always used for nefarious purposes, but it does often target minority groups or underprivileged groups. Don't want homeless people sleeping in your downtown? Uncomfortable benches and strategically placed spikes will help dissuade that. Don't want lower-class citizens visiting your neighborhood? Leave out sidewalks so it's less friendly to pedestrians. Vote to not have public transportation serve your area. There's even a story that a certain New York City city planner built overpasses intentionally lower than others so that buses couldn't drive underneath, which helped keep Black and Puerto Rican residents from getting to the beaches that the more wealthy people wanted to keep to themselves. So, I think it's safe to say that as long as there are humans, there will be an unequal and unjust distribution of resources. There will be envy, greed, and fear. I wish I could stand here and say that I had an answer for how we can solve poverty and wealth inequality, but in reality, we may never solve it. These have been problems since thousands of years before we were born, and they'll continue to be problems long after we die. But I do want to encourage you. We all have the opportunity to be agents of change. In fact, for those of us who are followers of Jesus, it's our responsibility to not just care, but to do something about injustice. In the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. And Jesus said that loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself are tied together as the single most important commandment. He didn't just mean that we should have warm, fuzzy feelings about people. He meant love as an active word that involves serving others and putting their needs above our own. So what if we started to see the world as a place of abundance? Not as a place of resources for us to hoard and plunder, but a place where we use our power and our resources to care for those around us, generously and without fear of lack, because we trust that we'll be cared for. What if the problem isn't scarcity, but it's that we have our priorities all wrong? Jesus had a lot of things to say on this topic, but I think this is among the most beautiful. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothes. Consider the ravens. They do not sow or reap. They have no storeroom or barn. Yet God feeds them. And how much more valuable you are than birds. Who of you by worrying can add a single hour to your life? Since you cannot do this very little thing, why do you worry about the rest? Consider how the wildflowers grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you, not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? And do not set your heart on what you will eat or drink. Do not worry about it. But seek his kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well." As Christians, we should be known for our generosity. None of us can solve the problems of world hunger or overconsumption or billionaire tycoons, not on our own. And please, don't hear me casting judgment if you are itching to get home to see if your Temu order has arrived, or if you've ever had to throw out an entire drawer full of produce because you ignored it and it rotted all. Yeah, that's me. There are only so many decisions that each of us can make in a day before we hit decision fatigue. And effecting real change isn't going to be a matter of always making the exact right decisions. In fact, there probably isn't one exact right decision most of the time. To quote one of the best TV shows to come out in the past 10 years, life is now so complicated it's impossible for anyone to be good enough. These days, just buying a tomato at the grocery store means you are unwittingly supporting toxic pesticides, exploited labor, contributing to global warming. Humans think they're making one choice, but actually they're making dozens of choices they don't even know they're making. So I do think it can be helpful to increase our awareness of what effects our actions are having on the world. So, for instance, before I started researching this, it never even occurred to me that my food waste was contributing to climate change. That's definitely going to make me think a little bit differently about my grocery habits in the future. But changing habits takes time, and it's usually much more sustainable in small doses. So if becoming a more ethical consumer is something that resonates with you, I put a few resources up on the screen here. And if you'd like to find me afterward or email me, I can send you more. I also kept track of a lot of the other resources I used for this, so if you have any questions about something I said, I can send you some bonus links. Again, it can be easy to get overwhelmed if you feel like you need to change everything all at once. That's not what I'm implying here. No one can do that, and I don't think God expects us to. As with many things, I think the answer has to start with love. Love for God and love for our neighbor, which, according to Jesus, means everyone. We must learn to set aside fear, entitlement, and envy, and replace them with humility, gratitude, and trust in our God of possibilities to provide abundantly more than we could ever expect to do on our own. And that's it for me. So I'll have Chris Kahn back on up, and we'll sing a few more songs.